So thank you very much for coming and to this last day of the IMFAR. So just a few announcements. First, everybody is invited to the IMSAR business meeting and at room 3. And there will be a lot of discussion about what IMSAR is. So IMSAR is more than IMFAR. I think you have to really to go to the INSAR and to take a ticket at the INSAR. I think this is really so important for the field that psychologists, clinicians, geneticists, neurobiologists are meeting and discussing about the international society for autism research. So I think this is really great, and please join us at the INSAR. And since it's the last day, I want really to, I mean, when Hélène asked me to organize the IMFAR, I think she was, I don't know, it was totally crazy to ask me that. And I was very, very, I'm very proud. I think it's really a fantastic meeting, for at least for me. And I would like, again, to thanks my three angels, Hélène, Suzanne, and Jennifer, who were really great. So, merci beaucoup. So, if I accepted to do the scientific share of the IMFAR, is for, you know, inviting Maureen Durkin. So, I think Maureen Durkin, she's an anthropologist and an epidemiologist, and I think she's doing an amazing work and about seeing the bigger picture about the epidemiology of autism, not only in Europe and US, but everywhere in the world, and try to go towards a more inclusive world. So I think this is why I accepted to do the IMFAR, is to have people like you here. So merci beaucoup, beaucoup, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Tomas. And I want to thank the entire IMFAR organizing committee for this outstanding conference and for inviting me to speak about the epidemiology of autism spectrum disorder. It is really an honor for me to be here, and I just want to express my appreciation for everything that INSAR and everybody at this meeting does to advance our understanding of autism internationally. What I'd like to do this morning is to make a few comments about what is epidemiology and why we even study the epidemiology of autism spectrum disorder. I'll then just give some brief descriptions of just a few of the recent developments in the epidemiology of autism spectrum disorder. And then, rather than try to give a comprehensive overview of the epidemiology, I want to focus on two ways in which I think the autism research field has been a little bit too narrow and could be much more inclusive. And in fact, we'll need to be more inclusive to make significant advances in our understanding of the disease. And one way that it's been relatively uninclusive is just in terms of where the research on autism is being conducted, which is largely restricted to the high-income countries of the world. And another way is that it's the focus of most of the research on autism, and especially in epidemiology, is an almost an exclusive focus on the impairment dimension, which from a disability perspective is really quite narrow. And I think we need to expand to include the functional dimensions as well as the participation in society of individuals with autism spectrum disorder. And so these are the things I want to focus on mostly. But in terms of epidemiology, the most common definition is it's the study of the frequency and distribution of diseases or other health outcomes in populations. And I emphasize the word populations here for two reasons. Epidemiologists try to go into a population and identify every case that meets diagnostic criteria for the disorder. Because if you don't, if you just study people who come to a particular clinic or maybe volunteers in autism societies, we'd get a very biased view, both in terms of the frequency of the disorder and the factors associated with autism. Another reason for studying autism in the population is that we have like a built-in comparison group or control group for investigating risk factors for autism. And also, if we didn't study it in the population, we wouldn't have a denominator for calculating prevalence and monitoring frequency over time. Now, the main reasons for conducting epidemiologic studies of autism are listed here, and they include monitoring the impacts on the population, estimating service needs, determining the causes and risk factors for autism, the effectiveness and cost-effectiveness of treatments, and for determining public health priorities and policies. Now, without a doubt, the most notable finding in the epidemiology of autism spectrum disorder over the past 50 years has been this dramatically rising prevalence, or at least in terms of how it's measured in epidemiologic studies. From the first studies conducted in England and the United States in the 1960s to where we are today, you can see that there's been a 100-fold increase, really, in the prevalence. What this green bar here represents the results from the study published in 2011 from South Korea, which really shook the world, finding a prevalence of autism of more than 250 per 10,000, or over 2.5% of children meeting diagnostic criteria for autism spectrum disorder in that community. The final bar here represents the results from our CDC ADAM network autism surveillance data from the United States. This is the most recent estimate of prevalence of just over 1% of children. But I want to point out that the single numbers like this from a country can hide a lot of site-to-site variability. And so that's illustrated here. The ADAM network includes multiple sites throughout the country. And what we see is that although the overall prevalence here indicated in this dotted line was just above 1% in the 2012 report, the variability ranged from less than 5 per 1,000 in the Alabama site to more than 20 per 1,000, or greater than 2% in New Jersey and in Utah. And I think it's hard to look at these findings without suspecting that a lot of this variation has to do with variation in the intensity of screening and services and access to diagnostic assessments for neurodevelopmental disorders in different communities around the country. Now, another thing I wanted to point out, just in terms of trends in the prevalence of autism over these past 50 years, is that we seem to be seeing the most notable increase has been in those children with autism who don't have intellectual disability. And this I inferred from a recent report, and my job in putting these figures together was made much easier by this publication in Autism Research in 2012 by Elsebag and colleagues, which is a fantastic systematic review of the world literature on the prevalence of autism spectrum disorders as of that time. And what you can see is that they reported information on whether on the prevalence with IQ in the average range versus prevalence in of autism with co-occurring intellectual disability. And you can see that the rise is most notable in those without intellectual disability. And to the point that I would say that before 2000, we would have estimated from the epidemiologic literature that two-thirds of children with autism had co-occurring intellectual disability. And in the post-2000 era, that percentage has changed and it's reversed. So now that about approximately two-thirds of children in this most recent time period with autism spectrum disorders have IQs in the normal range. I think this is a trend that hasn't been noted enough, but it's something about the changing epidemiology of autism. A few other developments that I want to point out, and I'm not being comprehensive here at all, in terms of the findings in the epidemiology of autism spectrum disorder, are, for one, we now have pretty consistent evidence from the studies that have been done of an association between parental age and autism risk. And while some studies find that it's father's age that is associated with autism risk, and other studies find that it's the mother's age, most of the studies that look at parental age find that something, one of them is associated. And now, recently, the largest epidemiologic studies that are large enough to separate the independent effects of paternal age and maternal age find that really both parents' age is associated with autism risk. And this makes our job in using these findings to direct etiologic investigations more difficult. In some ways, we wish it was just one parent's age. The association with father's age points to the potential for these de novo mutations, which is one of the things that the genetic studies are finding to be associated with autism, because the frequency of these increase with paternal age. But then the fact that mother's age is also associated with autism risk points to a whole other set of etiologic mechanisms, including possibly chromosomal anomalies, as well as a host of pregnancy complications that are associated with maternal age, as well as environmental exposures, which accumulate over time and may be associated with maternal age. And there are intense investigations, and many of them we've heard about at this conference, looking into the role of environmental and genetic factors and their interactions. And these parental age effects really kind of point the way in some of these. I think then one other sort of general point I wanted to mention about developments in the epidemiology of autism spectrum disorder is that there's been great interest in the potential impact of our new diagnostic criteria, the DSM-5 criteria for autism, which are expected out this month. And a number of clinical studies have been done suggesting that some proportion of children who currently meet criteria for autism will no longer meet criteria under the DSM-5. But it remains to be seen how this change in criteria might affect estimates of the prevalence of autism in the population. And we've been able to look at this with our ADAM network data, and we presented some of this last year at IMFAR, and currently it's under review. But I would just say that I think the effects are going to be relatively modest on prevalence, at least, based on these population estimates, if you just simply applied the DSM-5 criteria to retrospectively collected surveillance data. But I think that it remains to be seen, because diagnostic practices in the community are likely to adapt to the new criteria. So I wouldn't expect a huge effect on prevalence, but we'll be looking into that. I think, in any case, we can conclude from the analyses we've done that it's not going to have much of an impact on the rising prevalence that we've seen over time. We're not going to go back to 2 per 10,000 or anything like that. But turning now from just other epidemiologic findings to the main themes that I wanted to focus on this morning, and that is the some of the ways in which the epidemiology of autism and research in general on autism needs to be more inclusive. My first point is just the global disparity in the number of epidemiologic studies that have been conducted around the world and where they've been conducted. And as I mentioned, this my job here was made easier by this recent review by Elsebag and et al. But what we did was we, just using the R statistical software, we put the data from their review into this global map. And you can see that the countries where epidemiologic studies have been conducted of autism spectrum disorder are pretty much limited, for the most part, to the higher income countries. Most of the countries in the world, and this review concluded that really we know nothing about the prevalence of autism in African countries, for example. The countries on this map that are white are countries where there have been no, as of the time of this review, there have been no epidemiologic studies generating prevalence estimates on autism. And the reason this is a problem, I think, is that the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of people in the world live in low-income countries, in these very countries where there are no epidemiologic findings for autism. More than 90% of births now occur in low- and middle-income countries, and virtually all of the projected increase in population globally over the foreseeable future is expected to occur in low- and middle-income countries. Now, these are the data from the Al-Sabah review again, but here, instead of showing the number of epidemiologic studies, what we plotted was the number of confirmed cases from epidemiologic studies by country. And it pretty much shows the same thing. In the vast majority of countries in the world, we have no cases of autism have been identified in epidemiologic studies. But here, the country with the greatest number is the United States, where over 15,000 people have been identified in epidemiologic studies, and then it drops off precipitously. And again, as I said, most of the world, no studies at all. Now, this Gapminder graph, I think, conveys probably better than any other figure I've seen the disparity we have globally today in terms of both economic development and health, and the correlation between the two. What it shows is, if you haven't seen this graph already somewhere, the countries of the world are represented in circles color-coded by a geographic region, and their size is commensurate with the population size. And you can see that as per capita income or GDP increases, so does the average life expectancy of the population. So we have an enormous global disparity in both health and wealth, and they are correlated. Now, there are a couple of exceptions. South Africa is one here where, although the average per capita income is relatively high on a global scale, the life expectancy is only about 52 years. But for the most part, they go along this pattern. And you can see that the high-income countries of the world, where most of, or virtually all of the epidemiologic studies of autism have been conducted, are up here in this corner. Now, there have been a number of efforts to kind of address this global disparity in terms of knowledge of the epidemiology of autism, and including many reports that have been a growing number here presented at IMFAR, and many this year. So I think this literature, we'll be seeing it change over the next several years. One of the efforts that was made to address the problem has been UNICEF surveys that have incorporated screening for developmental disabilities into their mixed surveys in low- and middle-income countries. And these surveys have indicated that a very high proportion of children in low-income countries, with a median of about 25% of children, screening positive, meaning they're at very high risk for developmental disability, including autism and other things. But the problem with these UNICEF surveys is that there were no resources in the low- and middle-income countries to go beyond the screening. So there's no follow-up assessments, and not to mention any follow-up services for children at risk for disability. And I think this highlights an ethical issue that we face right now in the world today, where we have a capacity to do screening for developmental disabilities, but the resources just simply don't exist in most countries of the world for doing diagnostic assessments of autism spectrum disorder, or for referring children, even if we were able to do the assessments, referring them to services. It's just not existent. Now, what's shown in this map is the global disparity currently in healthcare expenditures overall for all types of healthcare. And you can see here that the map looks kind of similar. It's a few countries spend, notably the United States, spend a lot per capita on healthcare. But the vast majority of countries in the world are indicated in white here, meaning that the per capita expenditure is less than $2 a day. For most countries in the world, the per capita expenditures on healthcare for all things, that includes vaccines, antibiotics, cold medicine, everything that you need to spend health dollars on, is less than $500 a year. Now, why is this relevant to autism? Well, if we think about just the cost of getting a diagnostic assessment, I wondered what would be a representative number to put out here, and the only thing I could figure out to do was to do a Google search on the cost of an autism assessment, and this is what I got. It's a number of blog posts from parents reporting what it cost them to get a diagnosis of autism in the United States, and I would conclude from these, if it's a representative sample, it's about $2,000 just for the diagnostic assessment. So how do we reconcile that with per capita expenditures on healthcare for most countries in the world of less than $500 a year for all healthcare expenditures? And then if we look at what is the cost of getting services, the evidence-based interventions for autism spectrum disorders, here I've quoted some data that was published in the Los Angeles Times last year just about the expenditure on applied behavioral analysis in the state of California. And here the quote says that the cost is often about $50,000 a year or even more for a single child per year. And the graph shows the increasing expenditures in the state of California for autism-related services over the years and the increasing proportion that's dedicated to ABA. So it's just not, again, with the kind of resources available for most of the world, it's hard to see how this approach would be applicable. Another thing is that within special education for developmental disabilities in the United States, autism is found to be the most expensive form of special education, shown here, and these data are old. It's even higher now, but it's over $11,000 per year per child receiving special education service for autism. That's more than double the average cost for special education in the United States. And then if we just look at, in addition to the cost for autism therapies and assessments and special education, there was a study by Lisa Crowan and colleagues recently looking at just the general health care costs for children with autism. And what they found was that it's more than three times higher than for children without autism. So health care expenditures overall for people with autism greatly exceed other children. And then there's the economic analysis by Gans, which showed that in the United States, a child with a diagnosis of autism will have lifetime costs, and these are costs just of living a life that exceed the costs of people without autism, is more than $3 million over a lifetime. And this led Gans to conclude that when physicians make the diagnosis of autism in the United States, in addition to all the other referrals they need to make, they should refer the parents for financial counseling to begin planning for this expenditure for the child. So I want to now just make some comments on the association between autism and social class. Now, the idea has been around for a very long time, since the first descriptions of autism by Leo Kanner in the 1940s, that autism risk is elevated in highly educated families. That idea has been there in the literature. But then in 1980, Lorna Wing published this paper entitled Childhood Autism and Social Class, A Question of Selection. And she concluded that there is no difference across the social classes in the prevalence of autism. It's just that, as she says, it remains true that a knowledgeable and determined parent of an autistic child is more likely to obtain an informed diagnosis. Now, this paper was very influential because after it was published in 1980, at least in the English literature, you would not see any book chapters or reviews concluding that there was any kind of association between social class and autism risk. But we decided, using the ADAM network surveillance data for the state of Wisconsin, we thought we should at least have a look at it to see whether, in the United States today, there appears to be an association. And what we found was this really remarkable, almost dose-response relationship between the prevalence of autism and increasing socioeconomic status. Now, this pattern is opposite of what you expect for developmental disabilities. Typically, developmental disabilities, if they're associated with social class at all, the trend is in the opposite direction, with the highest prevalence in the lowest social class groups. Another thing we wanted to look at is another consistent finding that we have in the United States anyway, with based on our surveillance data, is a disparity across the race ethnicity categories, with the lowest prevalence over the years consistently being found in Hispanic children, shown here in the bottom line. And then this is followed by African-American children, somewhat higher than the Hispanic children. And then the white autism prevalence in white children in the United States is higher. It's considerably higher than Hispanic, and it's higher than the other groups in all of the years. And then this dark blue is the overall prevalence in the United States over the years. And one of the things we wanted to look at was to see whether this socioeconomic pattern could explain these ethnic differences that we see in prevalence. And it does. So what's shown here is we were able to combine the data from across the country, over 500,000 children under surveillance, and look to see whether we could find this socioeconomic gradient. And we did find it nationally as well, and then we stratified by these four different racial ethnic categories. We have white non-Hispanic, black non-Hispanic, Hispanic, and Asian. And you can see that in every group there is this SES gradient with increasing prevalence of autism with increasing socioeconomic status. Now, I think there are a number of important implications of this finding. First of all, if Lorna Wing is correct and this socioeconomic gradient is due entirely to what she called selection bias, I think today we would call it ascertainment bias. If that's what explains the pattern, then we have to conclude that there are significant disparities in access to diagnostic and other services for children with autism in communities all across the United States. And also, if this is true, then our current estimates of something over 1% of children with autism, that must be an underestimate. And if we really were able to count the prevalence of autism in all of the social class groups, we would probably that prevalence is going to be going up closer to the 2% that we've now seen now in a number of populations. Another implication of these SES findings is that it does appear that the difference in prevalence by race ethnicity that we see in the United States is largely, if not entirely, explained by the socioeconomic differences, because most of children, Hispanic children and African-American children in the U.S. are in the lower socioeconomic status groups, and so that's why that brings down their overall prevalence rates. And I should mention that it's possible that other mechanisms explain the pattern, the association between socioeconomic status and autism in the United States, and this is there was a really interesting study by Kokoro and colleagues who found that clinicians we're more likely to diagnose autism given vignettes, when the children's parents were highly educated than they were with all the same features described, but from a low socioeconomic status family. And so I think this is something that we have to consider as well in terms of a mechanism. Now, Dr. Sandra Magana, who presented this research last year at IMFAR, I think has gone a long way toward explaining the underlying mechanisms and pathways for this socioeconomic gradient in the United States. And basically what she found was that she tested the hypothesis that families with higher levels of resources are better able to get access to new technologies. And in a way, getting an autism diagnosis is like a new technology. And it's not something that's available to everybody. And what she found was that she had found that children who were Latino, or actually I should put it the other way around, non-Latino children in the United States were more than twice as likely, and these were all children with autism, non-Latino children with autism were more than twice as likely to receive ABA services with funding from the state and federal government resources. And the underlying mechanism and reason for this is that there's a policy in the state that in order to be eligible for these services, you have to have a formal diagnosis of autism by the age of 8 years. And the Latino families with autism were not getting that diagnosis until after age 8 because of the barriers in terms of access. And so then, because of that, they were less able to get access to the services. Now, I think this explanation is something that has a long history in medical sociology and research on health disparities, which the idea is that when we have advances in healthcare technologies, we see growth, and not everybody has access to those technologies, we see growing disparities in health over time. So these are those same gapminder charts, and this is from the 1800s, where we see that there wasn't very much disparity in the world, nearly the magnitude we have today, shown in this chart. Almost every country had average life expectancies less than 50 years of age. But with the advances in antibiotics and vaccines and coronary bypass surgeries and things like that, as those become available, access to them is not equitable across the world. And so what we've seen in response is this growing disparity in health globally. And I think that's partly what's going on in terms of access to autism services as well, both within countries and globally. Now, we were hoping that with this figure shows the same SES gradient in the United States based on our autism surveillance data from the ADAM network in 2002 and then in 2006. And we were hoping that with all of the efforts now to promote universal screening for autism and better awareness and knowledge of autism in the population, we would expect that if it is due to ascertainment bias, this trend, that we might see the gap closing over time. But so far, we don't see any evidence. In fact, it seems to almost be increasing. The disparity in prevalence, determined from administrative records anyway, seems to be increasing over time, possibly due to increasing disparities in access to services. I would be remiss, though, if I didn't point out this really excellent study published last year from Sweden showing that the socioeconomic gradient in autism that we see in the United States is not a universal phenomenon. And in Sweden, where we don't have the same barriers to accessing services that you have in the United States, where there's universal access and probably less disparity overall in socioeconomic status, there is no such increasing prevalence of autism with increasing socioeconomic status. In fact, in Sweden, they found the more typical pattern for developmental disabilities, where the highest SES quintile had the lowest prevalence, and that the lower lower SES groups had a slight but relatively higher prevalence of autism. Now, this slide just shows some of the media images, in the United States anyway, of autism. And I think they kind of reinforce this idea that autism is primarily a white, high SES condition affecting males. But there are a number of promising developments, I think, and I want to mention some of these today in the remaining comments I have. And one of them is there's efforts here just within INSAR, including the Global Health Transfer SIG, which I just attended that meeting earlier this morning, that is beginning to address some of these issues of global health disparities. There's also the INSAR Cultural Diversity Committee, which is led by Tamara Daly and Marshall and Jürgen Alsop. And this committee is actively involved in trying to foster professional development and collaboration across the world with people interested in global aspect issues related to autism, as well as the racial and cultural and SES diversity in autism. And they're doing so much to sort of promote a more inclusive international association for autism research. And they do things like, tangible things like providing travel awards for participants from underrepresented countries, and also just activities to increase the sense of belonging in INFAR, and in the INSAR and INFAR meetings of participants from diverse countries around the world. I also want to mention what I think is a really important model for us to think about how to address the global disparity in access to diagnosis of autism and to services. And this model is our project for statistical computing, which many of you might be already aware of. Some of you may use this already. But the idea here is that this is free and open software that is provided under and protected under a general public license that really guarantees the ability of investigators and statisticians, in this case, statisticians around the world, to not only use the software at no charge, but also to modify it and to share their discoveries and changes and collaborate in making improvements. And they're not only allowed to do this, but it's set up to encourage this kind of collaboration. And as it says on their website, quote, it says, most licenses for software and other practical works are designed to take away your freedom to share the works, whereas this general public license model is actually designed to encourage this kind of global collaboration. And I think this provides a model for autism research because the tools that are available for diagnostic assessment and even many of the tools for screening for autism are protected by copyrights that make it impossible in a cost-effective way to do translations and adapt them for use in different cultures and things like that. But if we could develop something modeled after this R program, we could actually sort of harness the world's input from experts all around the world in developing better tools and modifying them, and also making them available, different translations of them available, so that researchers around the world don't have to keep recreating the wheel every time they want to modify an instrument. And you might, I just want to point out that when the R program was introduced, there was a lot of skepticism in the statistical community. And the purveyors of proprietary software, for example, just doubted that this would ever have the quality necessary for statistical computing around the world. And in fact, this is now the desired software by the best statisticians in the world are using R. And they're not only using it, but they're also, when they develop new methodologies, they actually, the sign that it's a really good one is that they develop an R program for implementing it. They then publish it in the peer-reviewed literature, And it has a way of assuring that global collaboration and input and peer review has a way of ensuring the quality. And it seems to me that some of these principles and this model might be applicable to autism research and tools and methods available for epidemiologic studies. I want to just mention another sort of hopeful model, and this is a website that was developed by Matt Mayner that's also like free and open and put out there for anybody to participate in. And the idea is to just provide a place to where people can post their tools and instruments that are used for disability screening and assessment and measurement of all kinds related to disability. With the idea that, you know, as he points out here, one of the barriers to research on disability globally, especially in low-resource settings, is the lack of high-quality tools. Typically, the proprietary measures, either they don't allow translation or adaptation, or they charge a lot of money for this right. And this just simply, or sometimes you have to pay for each use of the tool, and this just simply isn't feasible in most of the countries of the world. And it's been a major barrier, I think, to our global research on autism. Here are just some of the examples of tools and methods that I think are either freely available now or could be freely available. And some of them measure things like activities of daily living. The Weissman Activities of Daily Living Scale is open and free, and it's been shown to be very useful in evaluating adaptations of people with autism as they transition into adulthood. There's also, I just want to point out, the 23 questions that was published last year, or just this year in 2013, by Kakuza et al., which is a screening tool that now is useful for screening for autism spectrum disorders, and it was validated in Tanzania. And there's the neurodevelopmental screening test that we heard about earlier in this conference, developed in India, which I understand is going to be made available also in an open source manner. And there's many other examples, including the MCHAT, which there may be some licensing restrictions, but that is one that is probably one of the most globally used screening tools because it is available at no cost. Now, another model that I just wanted to mention in development, a way in which I think the epidemiology of autism needs to be more inclusive, and that is, it makes reference here to the International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health, which distinguishes three different dimensions of disability, and that includes impairment, which in autism would include the core impairments in social interaction and communication and repetitive behaviors and restricted interests. Those impairments would be here. But the ICF also distinguishes the dimensions of functional or activity limitations and then participation restrictions. And the reason for making these distinctions is that if you focus only on impairment, and I think most of the world research on autism right now is focused mostly on impairment in terms of the outcome. There's sometimes a limited amount that you can do to improve outcomes and quality of life for people with disabilities. I mean, everything that can be done should be done to improve, to reduce impairments. But as Nora Gross has said, the lives of individuals with disabilities are often limited less by the impairments, what she called disability here, than by the social context and interpretation of disability, things like stigma and environmental barriers that can cause impairments to be more limiting in activities and participation in society. Mm-hmm. This just shows some examples of ways in which environmental modifications can be made for physical and sensory disabilities to enhance functioning and participation in society. And it's interesting that these interventions are largely target sort of mobility and sensory issues, but they end up increasing the social participation as well of people with disabilities globally. And we've made a lot of progress in recent years in developing technology, barrier-free technologies, to enhance participation of people with disabilities. I think it's harder to think about what we would do to enhance participation of people with autism. The kinds of barriers to participation are different and can't be remedied using methods like this, but I think that's something that we need to do as a field in autism research, and it will go a long way in improving the inclusiveness and the participation of people with autism and the quality of life of people with autism. So this is just showing some examples of measures that do get at the different dimensions, the three dimensions of disability applied to autism: impairment, activity limitations, and participation. And so most of our instruments that we use for diagnostic assessment are here in the impairment domain, but we could be doing much more in incorporating them into epidemiologic studies to measure activity limitations and participation restrictions. And some of the tools available for this are listed here, but they haven't been used to date in epidemiologic studies that I know of autism. Now, I wanted to just mention another sort of model for research on autism globally that might be relevant, and that's the WHO-coordinated international study on the course and outcome of schizophrenia. And I mention it because, well, although this study was conducted years ago with the goal to see, can we confirm that schizophrenia occurs in different cultures around the world? Is it a universal disease, or is it only a Western condition? And I don't think we have any doubt that autism occurs in every population. It's not just limited to high-income countries or segments of society. But I think that it might still be worth doing, looking the way they did at countries around the world and doing some comparative analyses, because what this study found was that they found in many countries people, the frequency of schizophrenia was just the same as it is in every country, about 1%, but the outcomes were better in some countries than they are in more developed countries that had a lot more services and therapies. For example, they found that probably the main finding from this study was that typically people with schizophrenia in low and middle income countries were having a better outcome. They were getting married, they were working, they were integrated into the family and into society. So I mention this just because it's possible in our research globally that we might find better models in low and middle income countries for dealing with autism, and we should at least keep our eyes open to that possibility. Another sort of trend and development that I think is really important globally in autism and that could have applications is this movement to really improve the transition to adulthood of people with autism and to link people with autism to employment opportunities. And this specialist Eastern organization based in Denmark. It was written up in the New York Times last year and got a lot of attention. But basically, they're trying to match the special skills of people with autism with job opportunities around the world. And this article generated a lot of letters to the editor, including one from some famous autism advocates, which said, people with autism are no different from anyone else. They want a job, a home, and friends. And so there's just, I think, much more of a global interest in this dimension of participation and inclusion of people with autism and other disabilities. And another development I just want to mention is this is also embodied in two UN conventions, the Conventions on the Rights of the Child and the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And these conventions kind of show a paradigm shift away from viewing people with disabilities as objects of charity or just there for medical treatment, and changing that to thinking of them as a group who needs their human rights protected, and a focus on the quality of life and participation in society. And it's really echoing the same themes that are in the ICF and in the capabilities approach to human development. So in conclusion, I just want to say that I think we have a convergence of things going on right now in the world, including ideas and technologies, such as the ICF, these UN conventions, the capabilities approach to human development, inclusive schools and workforce, and coupled with the free and open tools that are emerging that will allow global collaboration. And I think that we can look forward to a much more inclusive world for people with autism, and also a more inclusive research on autism globally. And everybody's going to benefit from this. But I think to make this happen, epidemiologic research needs to be expanded to include low and middle income communities. And there has to be greater attention to the functional and participation dimensions of autism spectrum disorders. And so finally, I just want to acknowledge the support from the International Society for Autism Research. I want to thank Tomas for urging me to not just give a comprehensive overview of the epidemiology of autism, but to focus on these issues about inclusion that I think are so important in keeping us from moving forward at this point. I want to also thank the community of Donista San Sebastian for hosting this meeting, and I want to thank Matthew Maynor for his assistance in our programming for the graphics. So thank you very much.